I'd encourage you to keep your places marked there in Isaiah chapter 5. We're going to be looking at that chapter extensively this afternoon. It's good to see each one present. We're glad that you're able to be here as we are gathered to worship the Lord, to be able to study His Word together. Of course, with things that have been going on, situations, some of our members and being shut in or semi-shut in, it's always good when they are able to get out, and especially for an extended period of time. So it's good to have Selma with us this afternoon. And we're thankful for her presence as well as everybody's. And again, for any opportunity they were able to get together, I know we cherish that. That's a wonderful thing, especially for various reasons not able to come for a lengthy period of time. It's particularly good to be able to do that and to be built up and strengthened. And it's encouraging to us to see brethren who make special efforts to get out when it's very difficult and challenging. So we're encouraged by that as well. Thinking about Isaiah chapter 5 together for a little bit, kind of set the stage for what we find there. And I've entitled the lesson, Disappointing Vineyard. It's interesting that any number of the places you go to the scriptures and parables that you find refer to horticulture in some capacity. And so here's the parable that is being set forth. There's a parable, and we think typically the parables, we usually consider ones of Jesus that are found in various places in the gospel accounts, including, for example, Matthew chapter 13. And they're set forth a number of those that have to do with horticulture. One that is explained even in the context has to do with the parable of the sower and the land and what it does and the ground in which it lands and that which is unproductive versus that which is fertile and then produces fruit. And that's one reason why the parable is laying alongside something that's an earthly situation or circumstance that we can relate to for a spiritual lesson. That because we think about the idea of horticulture, we think about the land, we think about producing, we think about what yields come from that, it's easily to identify with it. And so the spiritual applications can be noted there and the explanations that are offered to help us to be appreciative of what's being taught. Well, here we have a reference to this idea of a vineyard. And again, vineyards are frequently referred to. Something that was well acquainted with, the grapes, the growing grapes. And so here's this vineyard. And now we're going to look to see, as it's explained, that it's described here, the parable, and the explanation that's offered as Isaiah the prophet is setting these things forth, having to do with the physical nation of Israel, the nation of Judah. And so he sets these things before them, and he's setting it in a way to kind of help them be appreciative of the consequences of circumstances that existed at the time and what's going to transpire as a result of it. So here you have this unproductive vineyard. Now, the reason it's unproductive is not the fault of the vine dresser. God had provided and cared for the nation. During that scripture reading, the first seven verses there lays it out. First of all, it kind of describes the situation here, that vineyard, and it's well cared for. The vine dresser comes in, removes that which would be obstacles, provides for it. It's going to produce, it should have been able to produce based upon all the good things that have been done in order to make the land fertile and ready to yield. And so here's God. He's provided care for the nation. He gave the nation all that it required. He blessed it bountifully. So it wasn't the fault there, is make the application spiritually. Rather, the vineyard yielded wild, unusable grapes. Israelites failed to obey God. The application is they just failed in every respect, in every way. And then what we see here in the rest of the chapter is that you start observing the various specifics associated with the things they were doing, behaviors and conduct that are condemned. And so as we just kind of begin to go through this and notice some things about it, I want to skip down for a moment to the latter part here of Isaiah chapter 5. And at the very concluding part, now it already has made a reference in this about what's going to be taking place, that it's going to be withheld, it's going to be burned down, the hedges, it's unfruitful, therefore it's not productive, it's not usable, so consequently it's going to be then destroyed. And so in order to accomplish that, we see the referencing to this idea, and of course this talking and describing the punishment that was going to befall the nation. That as Isaiah is laying this out, you're not doing what's right. So just like this vineyard, there's going to be adverse consequences. When you go to the 24th verse of that chapter, the rest of the chapter down through verse 30 describes and deals them with the ramifications, the consequences. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their roots will be as rottenness and their blossom will ascend like dust. Because they rejected the law of the Lord of the host and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel, therefore the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled and the carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they shall come with speed, swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt of the loins be loosened, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. Whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent, their horses' hooves will seem like flint and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. In that day, they will roar against them like the roaring of a sea. And if one looks to the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the cloud. So it's descriptive of what's going to happen. Of course, we understand the idea of the deportations, the coming in, the falling of the nations that's going to occur, that this is the situation that is represented in the time period. Because as the punishment that is going to be inflicted provided upon them by God, using these nations as an instrument to then punish them, and grievously so. And so this is set forth in this manner, in this way. And of course, we read the historical accounts and the things the prophets have to say about the matter, including Isaiah, and then you go back and you look and see what eventually unfolds as it involved the nations. And so the captivities that occurred, the destruction ultimately, when we think about Babylon and the nation of Judah, with the city of Jerusalem being destroyed, the temple, and then, of course, all the things that would follow after that eventually. But first of all, that was the nature of their circumstance, and it was self-inflicted. They brought it upon themselves by virtue of their conduct. And so this description here notes some things then that we go back and look at specifically. So not only does Isaiah give the general description and the idea that they weren't doing what was right, they were failing to obey the commands of the Lord, they rejected his word, he goes and describes some particulars. And these particulars pick up there as we look at verse 8. And there's a series of woes that are going to be described. And these woes that are going to be noted as it related to their conduct and behavior. And a woe, it sounds very ominous, foreboding, and there's a reason. The very word itself conjures up this concept and idea of something that is distressful and something that is going to come upon another. And it's a negative thing that's going to be something that you're going to be inflicted with. Woe to you. It conveys this idea in looking at various ways, lamentations of grief and sorrow, and the sorrow due to sin and the consequences that follow after it. The unworthiness of the nation is going to be observed. And why is the nation unworthy? Again, there's general referencing to this idea, but there's some specificity that we see attached to everything that follows after that. And so you begin to look then, and as we look at the various woes and take just a moment to kind of describe them. There's this idea of greediness that is observed in these verses 8 through 10. A greediness that exists. And as we start thinking about various kinds of sinful behaviors and conduct, what we notice some things is maybe we prioritize in our minds, set them in various categories. We might look at them and say, this one's worse than another one. I submit to you that they're all evil and wicked because they're a violation of God's law and his will. And therefore, sin which separates us is observable there. But some of these things, as we look at it, what we see is that there's terms that are employed, such as greediness. But then with that greediness, there's also some things that are noted as to how they satisfy that greed. And so notice with me these verses. Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field until there's no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. Now, that's the first woe. And this idea, there's a greediness that's attached to it. And in fact, some have suggested, as you look at the terminology, that they actually came and acquired land. And the acquiring of land, it may be even inferred that they did so in an unscrupulous manner. That the whole idea, because of greed, they were satisfying their greed, disrespectful of any kind of consideration as it related to their fellow Jews, to enable them to be prosperous. They took advantage of others in some instances, or at least the opportunities to increase their own situations. And so these houses, bunching them together and setting them up in certain ways, and even maybe in the envisioning of the idea of slum lords who pack people in together in order to extract from them the monies. All those things can be noted. And the underlying point is, whatever constitutes this, it had to do with the idea that they wanted to satisfy themselves with their own wealth, prospering in the idea of then a material blessings that they heap upon themselves. There are numerous passages that warned the Israelites how they were to treat each other and their attitude about what the Lord had blessed them with, and how that sharing of those blessings were to be done. Instead of taking advantage of others, they were to care for each other. They were to have a sense of how these things were to be done, so that those that were less fortunate could be profitably taken care of and properly seen to. And so you can turn, for example, just as one illustration of this, over to Leviticus 25. There's some things about the Sabbath, various Sabbaths that are noted there. I just want to highlight a couple of verses out of this chapter, because it does capture the essence of how they were to see each other. Instead of opportunities to further oneself and profit at the expense of the other, their generosity was to be the opposite, and their concern was to be evident. There in verse 25 of the 25th chapter of Leviticus, if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it but himself becomes unable to redeem it, then let him count the years since it sold and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return it to his possession. There's a description here about this idea of how you can get back what the Lord had given. And we know that when Joshua led the Israelites into the land, there had already been determined by the Lord, dividing up the land among the tribes, and even within the tribes, among the families. And so you inherited your land. And so the God, so that you didn't have these individuals who heaped the land all of themselves at the expense of the others, made provision so you could get back what belonged to your family heritage. And that even at the point in time, there was the year of Jubilee that's referred to, in which after 50 years, every 50 years, things would be restored in order to maintain a presence and to give all the opportunity to be cared for equally, and these inherited lands and properties would still be maintained within families. You drop down to verse 35. If one of your brethren becomes poor. So things happen. Sometimes perhaps people might say, well, they were not very wise in how they used what they had. Perhaps they, you know, some things about doing things in ways. Maybe they don't have as good money sense, so to speak, situation. There are things that happen outside of people's control. Situations that, because of circumstances, occur. And it had nothing to do with mismanagement. It just had to do with circumstances of falling them. And so now, how are we going to deal with these types of situations? Well, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. I'm the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave, as a hired servant, as a sojourner. He shall be with you, and he shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. It continues again in this vein and descriptive of this idea that even those ones, you don't use an opportunity because somebody's disadvantaged in order to then to take from them even more, to take advantage of that type of situation. There's some principles here as it relates to Christians and the idea of generosity, and even as God has blessed us, how do we look at what blessings we have? How do we view those things that we have? We have to be careful about this concept of wanting and possessing and all these things belonging to us rather than stewardship and what God has given us so that we care for others around about us. Now, certainly we can look at any number of passages, and I just want to briefly cover these points. I just want to give us a sense of some things that are stated, because sometimes when we start considering, and certainly this is true, as you think about all the different reprehensible behaviors of the Israelites and the journeys and circumstances and some of the things that they did, sometimes some of these areas that might not be as taken into account, some things that may not seem quite to rise to the same level of reprehensibleness, they exist. And what they do is they show a mindset. And that mindset leads to other activities. And if one already has an attitude of greediness and an opportunity to get more for themselves at the expense of others, or not to have the opposite, which is a generous attitude, which we are to possess, and so the occasions that we can utilize what the Lord has blessed us with to help others, then those are things we need to be aware of, because that was an issue that they had. And if we start thinking about the scriptures that talk about, if we say we love God, you know, go over to 1 John. John, the great apostle of love, and he says, you say you love God and you hate your enemy or hate your brother, then you know, liar and truth's not in you. If your brother has needs, if your brother, he goes through and says the love of brethren. So if how can you be saying on one hand, I love God, and at the same time, those that are his children, you don't show regard for and deal with them correctly and rightly. In Ephesians 4:28, it's even broadened in the sense that it describes not just brethren, but those we come in contact with that legitimately have needs and where those needs can be met appropriately. So he says, and it gives several things here associated with it, something that's wrong. You who stole, steal no more. So stealing is forbidden, and we understand that. But he doesn't leave it just don't steal. He says, working with your hands, there's the right way in which one is then going to be taken and be able to acquire things that they need. You're supposed to see to your family. That's totally legitimate as far as what's taking place. That these things need to be seen to, so you work with your hands to provide. But he doesn't even just leave it at that. Here's what you don't do. Here's what you're supposed to do in order to do it. But he says, so that you may have that which to help those in need. So we have to think in terms of that as well. And it's a mindset that enables us to have a proper attitude about those around about us, and where we can be a help and a benefit and a caring, loving disposition. Well, greediness is the opposite of that type of disposition that we find expressed in Scripture. Pleasure seekers. Okay, the pleasure seekers, and there's this ways in which we can kind of is noted and described. And in the 11th verse, woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue till night, till wine inflames them. The harp and the strings and the tambourine and flute, and wine are their feasts, that they do not regard the work of the Lord nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore, my people have gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished and their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp, and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. People shall be brought down. Each man shall be humbled. The eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. therein the lamb shall feed in the pasture, in the waste places of the fat ones strangers shall eat. So he describes some things here additionally, and also again gives some consequences of some of these conducts and behaviors and situations. It describes how some get up early. And so they're so involved in the idea of some activities of pleasure seeking as they view this thing that they drink and, you know, eat, drink, and be merry type of mentality. They're just taking these things in. And so as a consequence of that type of behavior throughout the day, they're feasting. Lewd partying is kind of described here. Often results in all kinds of immoral lifestyles. The society that we have around us, what do people seek after? They're going after things that they're trying to substitute, doing these various activities to find true contentment. And they use pleasure, or what they perceive again as these activities, in order to find fulfillment, find some meaning in life. And it's always going to fail. It's never going to be that which will enable one to find something that sustains them and gives them purpose. And you think about these individuals sometimes that in the world around about us, they seem to have every possible advantage. They've enabled themselves through the process of events to be prospered. They maybe find notoriety. You've got these individuals who are well known. They are people in various types of occupations, such as movie stars, and you then read about how they conduct themselves, and they have this money, and they start using it in drugs and various ways to find escapism and lewdness of all types of variety. And so here are these individuals. Well, I've got all this free time on my hand, and I'm going to use it to my luxury. I'm going to use it to try to satisfy these various pursuits in this manner and way. And so we find some intriguing ways in which this is noted and the ultimate consequences. It's like it's going down the grave and being consumed, swallowed up by the grave. That's Sheol. That's what's noted there. There's just going to be observable here the lack then of being able to accomplish things productivity, or be able to have things that are really going to be able to be looked at and viewed as something that's sustainable and good and wholesome. Well, he warns that's the end of that is pursuit is death and demise. There's an interesting thing that's kind of described here when it's talking about all these types of things. We have to differentiate a little bit. There's not anything wrong with, you know, having some hobbies. There's not anything wrong with pursuing certain pleasures that are right in and of themselves. There's not anything wrong with going and socializing with other people. In fact, we find scriptures that would indicate the good element attached to that and how we being together in settings that help us and be able to have a pleasant environment and to enjoy life. Scriptures don't preclude the enjoyment of life. It's the pursuit of the wrongful types of activities and how one seeks something instead of God in order to make something in their life meaningful, and which it again fails. It always does miserably. So you can listen to music that's wholesome and right. You can go and do reading as a form of secular reading outside of the idea of scriptures, which we ought to be reading constantly and continuously. You can look at all those types of things. So when we look at this, he's not talking about just any kind of pursuit that would be acceptable, right, and appropriate, but also one that doesn't supplant the Lord and do other things instead of doing what we need to be engaged in our knowing His will, applying His will, teaching His will to others. There's found over in Amos, and I wanted to turn to Amos chapter 6 for just a moment, because in Amos chapter 6, there are some passages that sometimes are misconstrued. And here again, the prophets, you've got these prophets, Amos being a prophet of God. And he uses some similar language. And in this similar language that we find with Amos is sometimes something that's taken and out of its context and been misapplied. You may have come across it sometime in some reading. I know that I even at one time, this was many years ago, heard a preacher actually make the statement and had taken out of Amos chapter 6 something that is not what the passage is referring to and misapply the passage. But if you go there and start noticing with me in verse 3 of Amos 6, and you'll notice some of the similarity. First of all, there's a woe. Woe to you who put far off the day of doom, who cause the seed of the violence to come near, who lie on beds of ivory, stretch out on your couches, eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idly to the sound of stringed instruments and invent for yourselves musical instruments like David, who drink wine from bowls and anoint themselves with the best ointments, who are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. Therefore they shall now go captives as the first of the captives, and those who incline at the banquet shall be removed. Now, notice the similarity of the language, and then it goes on down how the Lord God has sworn by himself, the Lord of hosts, says, I abhor the pride of Jacob and hate his palaces, therefore I will deliver the city and all that's in it. So, what some have taken, and again, the language of Isaiah and Amos are very similar. It's talking about people that seek luxury and they seek ease. They're not desirous of pursuing what was needful or right. And all they cared about was their own pleasure seeking in various ways. Some of the pleasure seeking wouldn't necessarily be wrong in and of itself, but the way that they did it. And certainly some of it, very clearly, is set forth that has to do with things that would be condemnable in and of themselves. But there it talks about this idea of they invent for themselves musical instruments like David. Some have taken that to indicate or to conclude that David had been wrong when he introduced instrumental music into the worshipful activities. That they've concluded that, well, that was wrong for them to have done that, that this was a situation that was not to be engaged in a sinful practice. But what you find is that David followed according to what he had been given to do. You can go over and notice there, as it relates to David's activities, Nathan, Samuel, the seer, all the events that are described over in 1 Samuel 29, it's referring back to David and what David did and the reestablishing some of these activities that involved the worship. And it notes there in those particular passages that he did according to what was observed, what had been given and stated as it involved then the pursuing of these rightful things that had to engage in their worship. They had the right to worship with instruments, and they did. And this was something that was pursued and done according to what instructions were provided. Other instances, you can go back in a little earlier there, you see the fulfillment of how all those things were being restored and accomplished. And what they did then when it talks about it was not a disobedience to what had been given, but the direction of the Lord to be fulfilled. The 25th chapter goes through and describes the implementation of the various things and what was done in order to achieve the responsibilities that they had. So I just make this observation because sometimes people will take out of context a passage. And in so taking out the passage, they make a misrepresentation. Some have falsely concluded and wrongfully come to the idea that what was done and by what Amos was condemning was David's participation and even instructing those to be engaged in the use of instruments in the temple worship and activities. I was looking for the specific verse and I thought I had it noted and marked, and I'm not noticing it right now, but it's in that context there and where it talks about the various ones that had given the instructions as a prophet and according to the commandment of God. And I'll probably think about it here in a moment. And I thought, like I said, I had it marked and I missed it, but I'll pick up on that with you later. But anyway, so having made that reference, it was just the idea what the real underlying problem was, both in Amos and what you see here, there as it involved Isaiah, was that they were engaged in doing something that had to do with their own self-seeking pleasure and not that which was going to be right and appropriate. In 1 Peter 4, 1 through 5, to kind of make reference to the events of the New Testament, notice what it says about how we are to put aside or these pursuits like that, that involve doing those wrongful behaviors. So it's not just what we find in the Old Testament scriptures. These principles are applicable throughout time. And those that are going to be following the Lord are going to make and apply these passages, these ideas correctly in their life. They're going to put the Lord first. They're going to cease the wrongful behaviors of which they had once been engaged. And so Peter then takes note of this, and he describes how people once were involved in these activities, and now we're to put it off. In fact, people look at us oddly if we once involved ourselves with them in these kinds of wrongful behaviors. There in the first verse, therefore, of the fourth chapter of 1 Peter, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lust of men, for the will of God. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In regard to these, they think the strange that you do not run with them with the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. This idea of giving account, that these are things that we no longer, if we put those things off in order to serve the Lord faithfully. And we go about living our life to his glory. We also find that, again, this was a problem with the nation. And the nation was going to reap the consequences of that. We find there that they enslaved to sin. And so there, the 18th verse, going back to Isaiah chapter 5, woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as with a cart rope. They say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come that we may know it. And so this is language that's kind of interesting. It's not language that we are typically going to be familiar with, but it conveys some things about the idea of sin and being then the figure describes a wicked harness to a wagon load of sin which they drag behind and unto themselves. They mockingly reject the warning of judgment by saying how they wish to see it. That this whole imagery is described. It's not just I'm living this way, but now while I've got myself harnessed in this manner and getting into it, the mocking of it and setting it lightly aside. And so that terminology or those expressions and the figures that are noted there conveys this idea. We think about how we once were servants of sin, but now we're slaves of righteousness that we find in Romans 6, 15 through 18. How we have put off that old man of sin and are now living for the Lord. That this burden of sin has been lifted, and we should rejoice over that circumstance. We think about over in 2 Peter, the third chapter, how they mocked and ridiculed that idea. Where's the Lord? He says he's going to come again. He hasn't yet arrived. And so the mockery and those individuals who are skeptics and live a life as if they're not going to be ever in accountability. That's the gist of what's being described. Well, they're warned there, as we find in 2 Peter 3. The time's coming as far as the Lord's coming again. Of course, there's all kinds of aspects associated with even physical death that occur prior to the Lord's coming. If the circumstance, we need to always be prepared for that. But the idea that the mocking and making light of sin, when we should set aside those things that hinders us and those things that cause us to fail to live according to God's will in our lives and following the Lord as we ought. And so the mockery that's observed there. Instead, we need to take to heart the consequences and how it's detrimental and how it destroys. And that this is going to come a time of accountability. We are going to give account of the things we've done in the flesh, whether they be good or they be evil. So enslaved to sin is noted. There's also, and this may be in this context, the most familiar part of this chapter to us because it's often made reference to or quoted and used and certainly applicable as far as things that we can observe around us. That's verse 20. Verse 20, notice these are broke down according to the woes and what's noted here. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Now, they distort values. They turn things upside down from what's good. They say it's the evil, and what's evil they say is good. That sweet for bitter, bitter for sweet, it's very descriptive of what we think about the situation, self-evident. People use terminology to obscure wickedness, the most reprehensible kinds of wickedness. Well, sinful immorality is an alternate lifestyle. We've heard that sort of thing, right? We start listening to people and they describe things and begin to try to figure out exactly how that coincides with the reality of things. You might hear about individuals who then are talking about matters associated with the idea of having certain freedoms. And these freedoms turn out that no more than license for doing wrongful behavior and sinful practices. And you call something a sin and you're condemned. It's considered hate speech. You know, people, sometimes these rights are intended that we use, and we're very desirous of our rights and upholding our rights. But some of those rights are not really rights that we have. They're just terms that are used, a way of expressing something, to give license for doing that which is wrong and some of the most reprehensible behavior. The idea of abortion and this idea and calling a baby in the womb a fetus to obscure the idea that it's life. And we can multiply that many times over. And we see more and more the acceptability of certain things because of terminology that's used that makes it less seemingly reprehensible. And drugs more and more being introduced into the nation in various and sundry ways. All in the idea of we have our freedoms and we have our rights. This destroying society. Now, we as Christians need to uphold what's right constantly, ongoingly. And no matter what the world sees it, how they talk about it or describe it, no matter what is set forth in ways to attempt to minimize what is absolutely reprehensible, we need to call it what it is. Sin. Ungodliness. And that which destroys, because if we are not very diligent, we begin to allow those that ought to know better and those that we're trying to teach and convert or those that we're raising, our children, that somehow these things are going to be acceptable. Instead of saying God comes first and above everything, and to call something, no matter what you call it, we go back to see what the Scriptures refer to it as. There are any number of passages, and not surprisingly, out of Proverbs, there's things that talk about this type of circumstance, so that in Proverbs 17 and verse 15, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. That's similar language, isn't it? Calling good evil, evil good. So now you're talking about various ones. Justify the wicked and you condemn the just. In the 24th chapter of Proverbs, and noticing there verses 23 and following, it states there about how these things also belong to the wise. It is not good to show partiality to judgment. He who says to the wicked, you are righteous, him and the people will curse. Nations will abhor him. But those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. That's the kind of thing that needs to be advocated, not the opposite of it. And in Romans 3 and verse 8, this is where Paul is expressing the idea that he's been falsely accused of saying, let us do evil that good may come, the ends justifying the means. Paul says that's slander. It's not true. I've never argued that's the way to do it. We are to be forthright in setting these things, and warnings about the distorting of values needs to be ever acknowledged and things that we oppose. In verse 21, moving along here, what are those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight? Well, here we have this idea of self-deception. Being wise in one's own eyes, deceiving oneself, we are about the task, consequently, of looking to self and elevating self, and as a result, rejecting the teaching and instruction of the Lord in our lives. It's doomed to failure. It's going to create for us circumstances that only by deceiving ourselves leads us away from what is true and what's right. Self-deception is warned about over and over in Scripture. And 2 Thessalonians, we find an interesting reference there in the 2 Thessalonians, and beginning in the second chapter in verse 9, where it notes, "Then the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they do not receive a love of the truth that they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them a strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they may be condemned who do not believe the truth and have pleasure in unrighteousness." Now, the language is fascinating because it describes some things. It says, well, God's sending a strong delusion. It's not the idea that somehow God is going to take people and put in their minds things to deceive them. Rather, it's descriptive of the very idea we're talking about here. They're self-deceived. They don't have a love for the truth. And these events in which people go astray, where they are self-deceived, results in their destruction. And so that's what's being noted here. It has reference to this idea of those who do not have a love for the truth. The antidote to self-deception is a love of the truth. That is the manner and way in which things can be rectified and right. So we go to the Scriptures for our guidance and direction. In James, the first chapter, you can look at verse 22 and following, but we'll just highlight a few of the verses here. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Is that not an easy deception to have? I hear these things and I'm satisfied with hearing, but I never implement the things that are taught. And somehow I feel that that's adequate and sufficient. That's the idea of self-deception attached to it. To believe a lie is to be led astray because I deceive self. Maybe arrogance, being pompous on our part, or looking and not having an understanding of what the word truth is, so others can lead us astray. And then we deceive ourselves that it's okay, that it's an acceptable circumstance in our life. And so, hey, I hear the word, and now therefore I'm satisfied. Well, in this setting, it says, be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourself. If you drop down to the latter part of this, and notice there in verse 26, if anyone among you thinks he's religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. Pure and undefiled religion before God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and keep oneself unspotted from the world. These are things to be done and things to avoid. And it's deception on our part if we think that that's acceptable to fail in regard to these areas. The last one, I'm moving along with looking at this, perverted justice. Going back again, these last verses, of course, we read down to the end there from 24 to the end, talking about the consequences related to the nation of Israel. Here we have then this statement, woe to men mighty at drinking wine, to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. There, this idea of drinking comes up again, the distorting of things that is a result of satisfying one's own circumstance. The idea then to take away the justice, to treat people in varying ways, to through bribery, because one's in a position to give someone something, and instead of doing it on the basis of what was right, the basis of what is just and proper, they turn around and do it on the basis of what benefits them, the bribe. And so this whole mentality is individuals who are self-centered, who only care about what they can glean and gather from this life and have no regard for those around about them. And again, just as a consequence of their conduct and behavior, are taking and rejecting God in their lives. And that was the mentality that existed in the nation of Israel, and that society, and that what the warnings were about. associated with it. In Leviticus 19:15, going back to the Old Testament scriptures, they're warned about not taking bribes or perverting justice. That was something that was just simply not to be done. That if you're in a position where you can make judgments and determinations, you don't do that. And this idea of respecter of persons, there again is an underlying idea, concept of respecting others, giving advantage to those that we can somehow be benefited by them. And you think about individuals and how we treat others. What's the mindset that we have, or what is the manner and way in which we go about dealing with those roundabouts? Well, if we see somebody who can help us in some way, we cater to them, don't we? Isn't that kind of the human nature? This individual, they have something that if I can associate with them in some capacity, if I can show them some kind of favor, if I can do something that ingratiates me to them, then in return, I'm going to get something out of it. Now, there's not anything wrong with being friendly with everybody and treating people rightly because it's right. I'm talking about the mentality and what's being described here. It's something I do it not because I care about them, but because I care about myself, and I can be advantaged in some capacity by doing this. Conversely, we look at the individual over here. They have nothing to offer me. They can't help me in any way. There's not any benefit derived from having some association with them. And so I kind of dismiss them or minimally have any involvement with them. Well, that's the respect of persons and partiality. And I would submit to you that a lot of the underlying problems and difficulties were that part of it. And really, as it related to the idea of why is it that I treat people the way I treat them? It's because of self-centeredness. And that's the underlying thing that you see here. Self-centeredness in all of these different things. What makes me, that I see something that helps me, see something that I want, see some pleasure that I desire, see some circumstance that makes me comfortable and happy. Of course, again, it's really vanity. It really doesn't exist there when people begin to dig beyond that. When things begin to unravel, there's not any substance to it. It doesn't provide for being able to be sustainable. Life changes and alters as far as those things. And what seems to be so precious at the time, personally, because it's something we want right then, it can go away in an instant, in a heartbeat. But our relationship with the Lord is always there, and there will be accountability. And if we think, well, I'm not a person that's in a position to render judgments, I'm not the judge in a civil case, and I can take a bribe. I'm not in that type of position. There are very few people that would fit that category per se. Of course, in the nation of Israel, God's law was a civil law as well as the religious law. And so there were those that were in these positions. We think about the Lord's church. And so maybe the application, just kind of tweaking it a little bit. How do I treat my brethren around me? Do I treat the ones that I think can help me good and the others I sort of discount? Do I view, as James, the second chapter, warns about people coming in amongst us, do I treat them differently because of how I see them instead of how the Lord views them? Do I care about people because the Lord cares about them and I'm supposed to care about them and that's to be our disposition? So again, instead of self-centeredness, selflessness. This is a product of what's described here. This is the circumstances that is observable. We're about to sing a song of encouragement. And as we think about this, sometimes reading about others, you know, kind of might help us to step back and say, you know, what is my status and circumstance? Am I susceptible? And do I find myself similarly positioned in which then I therefore go and go about these kinds of tasks? Well, it's good for us to do that self-examination and to evaluate. And am I a disappointed vineyard to the Lord? And when He's blessed me so bountifully, how do I treat those things that He's given me? When He's blessed me so greatly, what is my attitude about those things? And does He look down upon me and say, I'm really disappointed because you're not what you should be? Well, if that's our state or our situation this very afternoon, we stand ready to sit you because the Lord loves us and He gives us opportunity to make correction. He wants to help us to render these things good for us, and He provides for us. And those things are particularly true as it relates to our spiritual well-being. And if you're subject to the Lord's call in any way, won't you please come? It's together. We stand and sing.